Welcome to Parashat Bo. I want to thank our hostess, Paula Hertzberg, for once again graciously opening her home to us. This week's learning is dedicated by the Daniel S. Loeb Torah Center founders, Sally and Pauline Asa, in honor of their parents, Chacham Yosef and Norma Asa, and Tuni Misri and Eddie Misri, Ezra ben Victoria, Alav HaShalom. We're also learning Lilui Nishmatam, Rav Eli and Rezi Nedavud, Alehem HaShalom. And since today's class is going to be about the heart and the lungs, I also want to dedicate it to my mom's full recovery of her heart and her lungs. Mm-hmm. I see she's on here somewhere, so this is it. I'll talk to you and get started, but first I want to say that the name of the parasha, Parashat Bo, which normally means come, bo, to come, is spelt with the second letter of the alphabet and then the first letter, bet, and then the aleph. So it doesn't just mean to come to something. The way the letters seem to be going in reverse order, the B to the A, it really has this impression of returning, to go back to a primal place, to a primal source, from the B to the A. And so when God is going to tell Moshe in this week's parasha, he's going to say, Bo el Paro, come to Paro. He could have said lech. He could have just said go in a different way. But he's saying Bo specifically because coming to Paro signifies something. Up until now, who is Paro? What does he represent? What does he mean to us modern day? Who would be a modern day Paro? And not only that, we're going to discover that the Torah, as much as it is a story about the Pharaoh who wouldn't let his people go, it's also a story of our own personal internal voices, Pharaohs, forces that don't allow us to be set free. So when God's going to tell Paro in this week's parasha, Bo el Paro, he's really saying you need to face your fears. You need to come literally face to face, panim el panim. That's what Moshe is all about. His claim to fame that they'll say of Moshe is that panim el panim diberim ha'el. He spoke face to face with God. And what does that mean, to face something? To really be in a place where you are vulnerable, where you are transparent, where you're not afraid to be seen for who you are. And the reason I say all this is because in order for Moshe to get to the place where he's going to be the Redeemer, he has to go through a certain process and through a certain journey. And we too, like Moshe, we too all have our exiles, our journeys, our challenges, our enslavements, imprisonments, the things that hold us back. And this is the week. This is the week that we need to be brave enough to face those things that are holding us back. And so keep in mind this idea of Bo El Paro, meaning in order for us to go back to our primal source, and what do I mean primal source? I'll use an easy term, plan A. Plan A is always the ideal. It's always the best. It's always the first intention. It's always the thing that we'd like to do if we didn't have any obstacles. That's plan A. So Bo means go back. Go back from plan B and revisit plan A. Don't settle for plan B. Don't settle and say, well, I couldn't do A, so now I'm going to go to plan B, because that's going to lead you to plan C, D, and E, where God is saying, maybe refocus. You can't always accomplish your initial intent, but you always need to have your eye on what the ideal is. And so Bo is setting us in that direction, especially just practically speaking. His initial intent was to go to Paro. Let's just talk simply. We don't need to go out there. Simply, his initial intent was go to Paro and tell him, let my people go. That was plan A. All kinds of things happened along the way. And what's God saying? Don't take your eye off the ball. Don't take your eye off the plan that allows you to become your best self, to allow the people to become their best selves. And this week's parasha is going to give all of us a how-to, how to get to that place. And it recognizes that sometimes we have setbacks, and it's going to use different parts of the body to describe the seat of those setbacks. I'll give you a few examples. When it comes to Moshe, the first thing he tells God, when God tells him, I appoint you to go be the spokesperson for the Jewish nation. What does he say? What's his first response? Knee-jerk response. You picked the wrong guy. You must be mistaken. Are you talking to me? You want me to be a spokesperson? I am Ariel Sefatayim. I have uncircumcised lips. That means my lips are sealed, literally. I am Lo Ish Devarim. I'm not a man of words. I can't express myself, says Moshe. And then we are all Moshe. We have to recognize this. It's so much easier to read the stories as if they're about Moshe Rabbeinu. That's his story. It's not my story. It's much more sophisticated to read ourselves into the text. And reading ourselves into the text means we all have a component of this Lo Ish Devarim Anochi, of the I can't, I'm not capable, of the voices in our heads that tell us, who do you think you are, to go and speak in front of the highest supreme power of the free world, which wasn't free at the time, they were enslaved. But Moshe is all of us, because his voices and the narratives that he tells himself are the same narratives that on some level we all tell ourselves. So when Moshe starts out, we have this idea of the Lo Ish Devarim. I'm not a person of expression. I can't express myself. And what would cause a person to not be able to express themselves? I'll maybe say it a little different. People who are, I don't want to use the word introverted, it has different connotations, but people who remain in a state of silence, and we know you just mentioned the Holocaust story, we have this trauma, then Moshe himself, we'll start with Moshe, it's easier, and then we'll go to the national and maybe the personal. Moshe grew up in a place of trauma. What was his trauma? He's really a Jew, but he's a prince in the Egyptian palace. At a time where there was an edict to exterminate all Jews. So now you're Moshe. And if anybody was going to give you any survival advice, they would say, keep your mouth shut. Don't say anything, because anything you say can and will be used against you. And now Moshe is growing up, and it tells us clearly throughout the narrative that he doesn't know who his brothers are. Are his brothers the Jews? Are his brothers the Egyptians? He sees them out in the field, but he is a man in two worlds. And he doesn't fit into either world. His own brothers turn their back on him. His Jewish brothers are going to go and inform on him. He has to run and be a fugitive his whole life. And his Egyptian brothers are happy to have him killed, are happy to be done with him. And so where is he? Where is Moshe? Moshe's stuck in a place where the only way he has a chance of survival is by saying nothing, by not speaking. And now we start to get into this idea that Moshe is really a prototype of a lot of us, and we see it today. First it started with the cancel culture, then it started with, you know, if you dare show who you are or express your ideas that are contrary to the ones that are popular or to the ones popular in the host country, you're going to be silenced, you're going to be canceled, you're going to have to pay a price. And it's a very scary reality. We're first, maybe now, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, we may not have been able to associate as much with this. But Moshe is living at this time where expression is not allowed for him. And so God comes to him and he tells him, and I'll just say one thing because I say it all the time. The beauty of this is Torah is not defeatist at all. Because the man who can't speak, we said, becomes the greatest orator of all time. So this is not here to tell us to be defeated. This is here to tell us how to overcome the challenges and the obstacles that might otherwise defeat you. So if Moshe is in a state of concealment, maybe we'll use that word, he can't reveal who he is. What is God coming to? This is also another beautiful idea. If we're partners with God, as we say, we always are. We're not in this alone. So if we're in a state of concealment, what does God do at this exact time? Revelation. He reveals himself. And God mirrors for us what Moshe needs to do. Moshe, you need to come out from behind the curtain. You need to be able to be exposed, and you need to be able to express yourself. So on the one hand, we have this whole idea with the mouth, with the lips. Moshe can't express himself. We should know that almost every part of the body is going to be engaged in this exodus, in this redemption. This week, we have three plagues. I'll just, for a side, give you a quick little overview. The three plagues are Arbeh, which are locusts. It says the locust is going to cover En Ha'aretz, the eyes of the land. What does that mean? It's going to cover the eyes of the land. It's as if the eyes, we say, are the windows to the soul, maybe. It's going to cover the eyes. It's for us to read and say that there is not going to be any more the ability to have a transparency between what's on the inside and what's on the outside. Everything is going to be covered, and we see it in the next ninth plague, which is the Choshech, which is the darkness. So many people and scientists have tried to prove, and some of them do a pretty good job, of how one plague is a result of the previous plague. And so because of all this covering, there's a state of darkness now. Some people say that there was a big wind that came from the desert, and it, you know, excuse me.
There's water.
Thank you. And the darkness could have been from that the sand covered everything up in darkness. And then we go to Makat Bechorot, and we're going to talk about this idea of all these parts that make us up. Let me go a little slowly. Let me back it up a little bit. Let me say that last week when Moshe, actually 2 weeks ago, when Moshe came to Bnei Israel, and he told them, no, it was last week, that he told them that God is going to redeem them and bring them out of their land of bondage. They can't hear what Moshe has to say, and the language in the text is mikotzer ruach. So if Moshe is a person who is right now in a state of concealment, what, and that is going to prevent him from reaching his ideal of this, you know, redemption. What are the people experiencing? Because this is all one. I just want to make sure we understand that. The people are experiencing, the words mikotzer ruach in English might mean shortness of breath. Kotzer, katzad, is short. Ruach might be breath. What would cause a person to experience shortness of breath?
Fright.
So for sure, fear is at the top of the list. What else would
anxiety.
Cause a person anxiety? That's also on the list. Beautiful. What else? Fear, anxiety. I want you to think also of this choking. Have the imagery, the neck.
Closing up.
The lungs, the closing up. So this idea of kotzer ruach, and if you think of the neck as the thinnest part of the body, it's like Mitzrayim, Mitzaryam, this narrow, narrow space. The way Mitzrayim is described is as being in the straits, in the narrowest part. So what's happening? The narrowest part, the throat, the garon maybe even, the part from where the voice might travel, right? It might go from the air in the lungs through the throat, through the voice box, through the throat. Moshe can't speak, and the people have no wind. What's really happening? In order for speech to happen, you need to have both. The lungs need to be functioning. They need to be able to give air and wind, and that goes through the vocal cords, and they are a way, they are a vehicle for Moshe to be able to speak. I'll say it differently, and we know this. The people that we think we're going to redeem, the people that we think depend on us for their redemption, are very often the people who end up being the means by which we end up redeeming ourselves. How many stories have you heard in the last couple of months of people who go on solidarity missions to Israel, and they go thinking that they want to do their part, and they want to lift a little bit of the burden, and they want to show their sense of brotherhood and care and solidarity, and they go to Israel with every intention of being a light and a positive force there, and then what happens when they get there? I don't think a single person came back that didn't say the same thing, which is, we went to give them strength, and seeing them, they ended up doing what you went. So they ended up being a source of strength and of healing for us. We felt their pain and they alleviated our pain. And so I want to start to get this idea. Moshe can't speak and the people have no breath. And you need the air in the lungs to produce the breath. And we're going to see that the more Moshe helps to alleviate the people, the more he's going to be able to express himself. And it's the two working together that's going to bring the ultimate redemption. Now, with this little lungs and voice, Moshe's voice and the people's lungs, this idea of kotzer ruach, this overcoming, what do they have to overcome in order to be able to allow the flow of air, in order to inhale, in order to be able to exhale, what has to happen? All this trauma, all this fear, all this anxiety, and they say, "Mi kotzer ruach ume avoda kasha." We would think it's just physical exhaustion, but the physical exhaustion is actually a result of the lack of air. And what else is ruach? When we say lack of air, I don't just mean carbon dioxide going through our lungs. What do we mean by kotzer ruach? What the Egyptians did by giving them, by oppressing them, is they shortened the amount of ruach. What else is ruach other than physical breath? What does God breathe into us? Spirituality, his own breath, our godliness, that part inside of us. You could call it the neshama. You could call it the part that God breathed inside of man. What did they want to do? What do the people want to do today? They just want to eradicate God from the equation. Let's call a spade a spade. Years ago, they wanted to take God off the dollar bill. Years ago, they said, we can't pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, right? Mm-hmm. Because we're under God indivisible. We don't want to say we're under God indivisible. And little by little, they want to erase, eradicate, and cancel God out of the picture. It's no different than what they did in Egypt. They wanted to give us backbreaking labor so that we wouldn't have ruach, because they wanted to totally squelch and squash our spirituality, our connection to God. And what happens? We lose the ability to cry out to God because we don't have what? We don't have enough air. We don't have enough breath. So what does God say? You have to be their mouth and you have to be their voice. And in all of this, with this whole equation, who do we find over and over? Pharaoh also has an organ that's highlighted for us. And which organ might that be? Every time Pharaoh is supposed to do the right thing, what happens to him? His heart is hardened. What does that mean, his heart is hardened? And just so that we're accurate about it, the first five plagues, Pharaoh hardens his own heart. The last five plagues, God hardens his heart. And there's a big discussion of whether or not Pharaoh had free will. I'm not going in that direction today. I'm saying, why does God choose of all of the organs, the heart? You're giving Pharaoh the heart? Give us the heart. Give him something else. give him the sciatica nerve, give him another one. I mean, we have a lot of things taking place. Why does Pitagor get the heart? Because the heart is in the chest cavity. The heart sits not only within the ribs. Where does it sit exactly? Right between the lungs. Right between the lungs. So what's pressing on the lungs of the people? What's not allowing for them to breathe? This heart of Pharaoh, the harder it gets, it's not pliable, it's not flexible. He's not flexible and he's not pliable. That's an easy correlation to make. But Pharaoh's hardening of the heart, sitting and pressing on the lungs of the people, is the problem. But what's even more beautiful, the imagery that the Torah gave us, it told us all this in the beginning, in Parashat Shemot, when it spoke of the burning bush. If you picture these branches, and you picture them like the rib cage, and inside the rib cage, you have what? Fire. And what might that fire represent? Because you need oxygen. If you ever want to put out a fire, if there's a thing here, you put this like this, and you stop the air, and what does that put out? It puts out the fire. What's happening in this rib cage? What's happening in the iron gates of Egypt? It's getting oxygen, the oxygen, and the fire. The heart is synonymous with fire, right? My burning heart, let's say. The fire and the oxygen are doing what? They're both coexisting. And they're in this rib cage. And now here's where we are. Nobody wants to give an inch. The people can't breathe. Pharaoh is digging his heels in deeper and deeper, toughening himself, hardening his heart. We should know just one little nice fact about the heart. Spelt lev, it really is the entire Torah, like Parashat Bo, from the end back to the beginning. The heart's going to take us, what do I mean the heart's going to take us from the end back to the beginning? The last letter of the Torah is a lamed, from the word Yisrael. The first letter of the Torah is the bet for Bereshit. The lev is what's going to bring us back to the beginning. So we have to talk about it a little bit. So Paro's heart, we understand, is hardened. What does it mean to have a hard heart, by the way?
Stubborn,
for sure. What else?
Insensitive.
Insensitive. And I'm so happy that you said that, because Paro's game plan is zero heart and all mind, calculated, cold and calculated. What do I mean by cold and calculated? Who is Paro? You'd like to think, you know, we like to think of like a Hashverosh, these fat and sloppy kings. He's sharp as a tack, Paro. His first order of business is, he says, Hava nitchakemalo. What are we doing to the Jewish people? We're going to outsmart them. What does that mean? We're not using an army. We're not going to outstrength them. We're going to outsmart them. Because our game is going to be a game of the mind. But why is it a game of the mind? Of course, the art of war, you have to outsmart, you have to know your enemy. Of course, it's a mind game. But why exactly is Paro's approach one that's going to use only mind? And we know it from the Holocaust, we know it from the Germans, we know how were they able to perpetrate these crimes against humanity? And they were the most cultured. They were the doctors and scientists, and they were the smartest people. How did a generation with so much smart, how did the professors in the universities, how did they perpetrate what they're perpetrating? How is that? They're playing a mind game. And what is the mind game? This is what we see from Paro and we see till today. They're gonna employ only intellect at the expense of what? The heart. They're not going to use the two. They're just going to do cold, hard facts. What are the cold, hard facts? These people, they came without a penny in their pocket, and now look at them. What they have is ours. You're just taking back what belongs to you. That's a mind game. That takes away any thought or feeling of compassion, or that the people that you are creating these atrocities towards are human. So the idea that Paro is going to be what? What does he have to do? The only way he's going to be able to take an infant and drown it in the Nile, or put him as a brick in his buildings, is by doing what? Only what? Using the mind and not allowing the heart. That's why we call it the hardened heart. When something is hard, it's protected. It's not permeable. It's not going to allow feelings, compassion, emotion, because the minute you stop to feel what you're doing, you can't carry it through. Yes, did
this
you want to say
exactly
something?
Exactly what the Hamas is doing with the hostages.
Exactly.
It's the same exact story.
Exactly. That's what I was just thinking too.
Dehumanizing them.
Yeah, exactly.
And
playing games. They're alive. They're not alive. They're dead, you know.
And this is a story that was, that is, but that no longer will be. Because when we learn this lesson in Parashat Bo, and Parashat Bo is going to give us the how to get out and break loose from this vicious, horrific cycle that humanity is somehow able to perpetrate, now we have to say, look, we did get out of it before. We will get out of it again. But every time we need to be that much smarter. And I don't mean smarts without compassion. I mean intelligence. So what happens in this week's parasha is a very interesting story where Moshe, it's really pretty something you might not pay attention to, but I think it's important. Because if we're going to lay the groundwork for how it is that we are going to reconnect to God and pave that road towards redemption, Moshe says this thing to Pharaoh. And he says, Pharaoh asks him, and he says, Mi va mi haholchim. All right, Moshe, I know you want to go. The original ask was, we want to go to the desert for 3 days to serve our God. And Pharaoh says, okay, so give me the particulars. What's the plan here? Make me a proposal. And Moshe says, Bin Arenu, for those of you following the Chumashim, it's chapter 10, verse 9. Vayomer Moshe says, Bin Arenu ubezikneinu. We're going to go with our young, and we're going to go with our old, Nelech. Bebaneinu ubibnoteinu, with our sons and with our daughters. Betzoneinu ubibkareinu, we're going to go with our cattle and our flocks, our livestock. Kichag Hashem lanu, because this is a holiday for Hashem to us. So if we're going to connect to our God, this is for us as much, again, as much as it's about Moshe wanting to take his people on a seminar in the ocean, in the desert, where they're going to all get together and celebrate God. This is written here for us. And I think what's being said here when he says the first people that he's going to take, our young ones, and then our old ones. First, we should notice that there is this balance. We're going to take the young and the old. We can't have one without the other. That's clear. We're going to see a lot of balances. But what does he mean to say when he says our young and our old? What is he telling us? What's the Torah? He could have just said, everybody's going, chalas, say the million words, and it's over. No, he said, we're going with our youth and with the elderly. What would be symbolic of the youth? So yes, the youth are vulnerable. Maybe they're not completely developed yet. What might be something, and I'll say it in these words, when we come to God and we reconnect with him, we need to bring our young selves and our old selves. And what do I mean by that? What is Moshe saying to Paro, which he's really recording here for us? When we come in front of God, what does that mean to bring our young selves? What would be a typical characteristic of a young self? Maybe a person with energy, enthusiasm. These are things that a young person might have, maybe eagerness, idealism, zeal, passion, ambition. we have a young person is just so much, has so much vibrancy to them. That has to be part of our connection to God. We can't come to Him beaten down through all of life's trials. We can't come down to Him only as our older selves. And old. And by the way, there's a lot of pluses to the older self too. I shouldn't have presented it that way. What does the old self have to offer?
You say you know where you come from, you know where you're going.
You know you have experience. You know where you're coming from, you know where you're going to. Beautiful. The best shuls are the ones that have the elders and the children. Mm-hmm. You need both. You need the kid who's making noise and his lollipop's getting stuck to the carpet. Don't throw him out so fast, because you need that kid. You need that sense of energy. You need that sense of vibrancy. We all, every congregation, every kehillah, and I'm saying, see, it's so much easier to see it as a congregation. That makes sense. Yeah, we need everybody. But when we speak to the person on an individual level, we too, when we stand in front of God, we have to bring all of ourselves with us. We can't just bring ourselves with the experience. Because what does experience also sometimes prove for us? Sometimes our old selves might be a little more cautious. Sometimes our old selves might use a little more discretion. It's a good thing, mm-hmm. right? Because sometimes kids aren't so discreet and they just say whatever they're thinking. And so we need the balance. But sometimes the old self thinks, but sometimes it overthinks. And so it needs, again, it needs to be tempered. So when Moshe says we're going to come bin arenu ubezikneinu, he's saying, if you want to celebrate God, bring those two facets of ourselves, balance them out, and bring that, and that is what God will celebrate. So now we're on this journey. And we might feel beaten, and we might not have a voice, and we might not have the ability for the air to pass on through our lungs because this heart is so hard inside of us. Now, it's easy to think of the heart as being Paro's heart, but it's all part of one organism. So we also have our hearts, and we can allow, sometimes what do? We get to the point, every decision that's made is part logic and part emotion. And whichever one rules the day, you know, there's a conversation going on. It happens sometimes in a nanosecond. We don't even know that we're doing all this math. But when this is taking place, when the brain and the heart and the brain and the heart are doing what? Sending signals back and forth to each other. Should I, shouldn't I, should I? Cross the street, don't cross the street, it's yellow, I could run for it, you can't run for it, you might trip, be wearing the right shoes. All these things are happening in your head and you don't even realize they're happening. But what has to really happen? If we want to move forward, if we want to get to this place that we're going to call the promised land, we have to balance the two, and we have to make sure that we're always in a state of bo, that we always have our eye on plan A. The decision that we're making today has to weigh in on, is this a stepping stone for me to get to the ideal place? Bo, are we able to do that? Are we able to, again, we're talking about the Jews that gave up hope of ever leaving completely. Did they think they're gonna dance on dry land in the middle of the sea? Did they think they're gonna go see a place that's flowing of milk and honey? Is that something that they could even conjure in their minds? That would be plan A. And that could only happen if we have this Chag LaHashem. How are we gonna connect to God? We can't just stay in any one modality. In this beaten modality, we have to still go back to that place where anything was possible for us. And so as we're reading the Pesukim, the first time, that's what Moshe says. And what does Paro answer? He says, I know you people. You're not going to go. You're not just going to worship 3 days. I don't trust you. Why would you need your children and your sons and your daughters and your cattle if you want to go worship God? He says, nope, I'm not letting you go. I'm only, if you want to go, on this condition. Only the men. The men only. Moshe says, it's not a negotiation, it's all or nothing. Either you let us all go, or we're bringing you the arbeh. I'm sorry. Or we're bringing you the locust is going to come upon you. The next time we see this little negotiation happen, let me just see where we are. The next time we see this story happening, the locust comes, destroys everything, and the darkness comes, and Paro is beside himself, and he says these words, all right, Moshe, you win. Take your sons, take your daughters, take your wives, only leave back the cattle, the livestock. Why would he say only leave back the livestock? And Moshe answers him and says, no, I'm sorry. We're taking Gam Miknenu Yelech in verse 26. I'm still in chapter 10. Gam Miknenu Yelech Imanu. Lo Tisha'er Parsa, not a single hoof. You know, from the laws of Kashrut, Mafreset Parsa, Shusa, Chesa. Parsa, not one hoof is going to stay because we're going to take those and we don't know when we get there what animals we're going to need to sacrifice. What was Paro really saying? I read a beautiful thing. It is by Yitzchak. Give me one more second. I wanted to give the credit to the, I think it was called Yitzchak Israel. It's called the Yehudi HaKadosh. Oh yeah, Rav Yaakov Yitzchak. He's known as Yehudi HaKadosh. He says a beautiful thing about what Paro was suggesting. And of course, it needs to be relevant to us. He said what Paro was suggesting to Moshe is he was still trying to convince Moshe and say, what do you need all the rituals for? You want to go serve your God. Go with your heart. Go with your words. Go with your intent. But what do you have to sacrifice? What do you have to take action for? What do you have to practice and follow all of these laws and rules and regulations? Leave the sheep behind and go with your intent only. Bypass all of the actions and rituals associated with your religion. I thought that was a beautiful reading because Moshe is gonna say, we can't do that. It's one and the same. The way the lungs and the voice work together, you can't have sound without the air from the lungs. Our religion needs both. It needs the intent and it needs the action. The intent and the action need to correlate and correspond with each other. And so Moshe is telling every one of us, if those are the conditions that we're just gonna go serve, you know, people say I'm Jewish in my heart. I'm happy, it's nice, it's a nice thing. I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but if you're reading Parashat Bo, you can't just be Jewish in your heart. Judaism requires a counterpart to the mind, and that's the action. And since we're talking about actions, and since we're talking about all the parts of the body that's being spoken of in these parashiyot, what is God? How does he describe himself? You know, sometimes there's the flaring of the nostrils, so sometimes you have the nose, sometimes you have, I mean, the different parts that God might use to describe himself. But throughout the entire Exodus experience, how is God described to us? He's described as having a yad chazaka and zroa netuya. Thank you. What am I saying? God, imagine that God didn't give himself the heart. He didn't give himself the mind. He didn't give himself the voice, which of course all of these are anthropomorphic descriptions. God isn't human, so he doesn't really have these. But he chose for himself, when everybody was picking which costume they wanted to wear and which part of the play they wanted to pick, what did God pick for himself? He picked the hands and the arms. What is a Yad Chazakah? You know what God is saying? I'm going to take the body part or the organ that most describes action. Because it's not enough to talk a talk, and it's not enough to think the thoughts. I'm going to be the one who's going to represent the importance of action. And together, Moshe, together with you talking the talk, and with the people literally breathing, giving breath, giving air, giving life, it's the people plus Moshe plus God. And God said, in this story, I'm taking action. Now, of course, it's nice. We could sit back here and say, beautiful. That's the whole story of the Exodus. Atem tacharishun. You sit back and what? God says, I'll do everything. I got this. You need a sea split? No problem. You need a frogs coming at? No problem. God says, I'll take care of everything. So don't get too comfortable. Why? Because God played the role of the hands and the action, and it's recorded here so we could be his understudies. Because there's gonna come a time when we're gonna have to be the ones to take action. He's just modeling for us what we're capable of when we take that deep breath, when we bring godliness inside of us, when our ruach isn't katsar, then what are we capable of? We're capable of action. And what are God's actions, by the way? They're fantastical. Every one of his actions is greater than the next. There's kinim, there's wild animals, there's darkness, there's all kinds, there's hail filled with fire dropping from the sky. What is God telling us? He says, those are my actions, and you're my mirror. You're created in my image. So don't think for one second that the actions that you take can't also defy the laws of nature, because they can. And how many stories do we read? How many wars have we won? How many miracles have we seen in our day which really defied logic and really defied the laws of nature? And Hashem is here giving these to us to tell us this is what we're capable, and all of these pieces are part, are bricks in the road to this redemption. We have to have this knowledge. We have to have this mindset that just as God is able to, so too we are able to. Now, this was just a little bit of a build-up, because what is in this week's parasha to me is one of the most magnificent portions. It's called Parashat HaChodesh. It's read before Pesach. Parashat HaChodesh is, it's chapter 12 in Sefer Shemot. Parashat HaChodesh is so beautiful for so many reasons. If I know I say this, but this one really, if I had to pick a favorite pasuk, I'll tell you why, because it's something that is an artistic, linguistic, literal masterpiece. The introduction, I'll take a step back a minute because I'm getting a little excited about it. Calm down first and say this. Of all the verses for Rashi to quote, back in Bereshit, the first beginning of creations, what does Rashi jump in and say? The Torah, if it was a history book, should have started with this pasuk that I'm about to read to you today. Because it's our first national commandment. It's the first commandment that we get as a nation. And Rashi is saying, you know what? If you were going to start a book talking about the emergence of the Jewish people as a nation, you should start it with the first law that they were given. And then he goes and answers his own question, and he says, no, it's here to tell us that God created the world, and it's his to do at his behest, at his choice. And the two versus speak to each other. And what do I even mean by that? So I'll give you the verse first. If I had a smart board behind me, I'd be having a party with it. I'm going to read you. Hashem tells Moshe and Aharon in Eretz Mitzrayim, and this is what he says. And for my friends that are Zooming, they'll appreciate to see that it starts with Vayomer and ends with Lemod, even the introduction to this upcoming special verse that I'm now crowning. Even the introduction starts and ends with Lemod, which means that the introductory verse has the same word in the beginning as it has in the end. It's as if the verse is reflective. It's as if it's looking at itself in the mirror. But it gets much more beautiful because everything we're going to see in Parashat HaChodesh, I should take a step back and say Parashat HaChodesh is the passage that designates the month of Nisan, the month of the Exodus, as being the first month of the year. I'll back up and I'll say this. God is saying to us, I may have created the world in Tishrei, right? The new year, where we dip the apple in the honey for a sweet new year. When is that?
Usually in September.
Yeah.
Which is Tishrei. Tishrei, the first of Tishrei, the second of Tishrei, that's Rosh Chodesh. God said, Rosh Hashanah. I made that the beginning of the year because that's when I created the world. But guess what? I'm willing to step back. I'm willing to step aside and allow for this month, the month of Nisan in the springtime when Passover happens, I'm allowing for this month to be the new year, the first of the year. The month in which you are going to become a free people, that is going to be more important than the month in which I created the entire world, because it's the month in which you become created. It's a recreation of man, a rebirth. Thank you. And then what's so beautiful? Why do I get so happy when I see things like this? Because the words that he used to describe this thing that I just said, that the seventh month is now going to become the first month. If you think of it like a clock that has 12 numbers on it, the first and the seven are literally opposite each other. So it's as if God took the clock and went like this, rotated it completely. He took what was on the top and put it on the bottom, and he took what was on the bottom and he put it on the top. But how he describes this is nothing short of magnificent. He says, HaChodesh hazeh lachem rosh chodashim rishon hu lachem lechodshe hashana. I'll translate. He says, this month is for you, the head of the months. It's the first one for you for the months of the year. Sounds a little bit tongue-tying, but I'll say this. If you read it, you'll see that you need only the first half or the second half. You don't need both of these halves. You can just say, this month is for you, the head of the months. Or it's going to be the first one for you for the months of the year. One or the other. But it's said twice, and I'll give you an easy way to process that everything that's going to be said henceforth in this chapter is going to be said twice. Why? Because this is not just for the Pesach Mitzrayim. It's being said once for the Pesach that we experienced in Egypt, and then it's being said again for all subsequent Passovers. So everything that we read, we're going to read Sele Bet Avot, Sele Bayit. Same thing. You're going to bring a sheep for your house. You're going to bring a sheep for your house. You're going to bring Hu Ushcheno, he and his neighbor, Hakarov El Beto, the one who lives close to his house. Well, the one who lives close to his house is his neighbor. Every single thing that's going to be said is going to be said in duplicated form. So when we're reading this now, never should we think to ourselves, oh, this is for them. This is their story, and this is what they had to do back then. There were even communities, I've heard from some of my ladies, that on the night of the Seder, they put like a red paint on their door to replicate the, because they feel that everything that was being said here needs to be done in all future generations. And so this is definitely something that we should be excited about. because it's not something that's stuck in the past, but it's brought into the present. What's being said here, if we had to just try and depict for you the words, it's the words start with Chodesh and end with Chodesh, months. And as we move towards center, we have the word Lachem. And as we move towards center again, we have the word Rosh. I'm telling this to you because maybe you could envision it this way. You have A, B, C, word A, word B, and word C. And then as the verse continues, you have C, B, A. It's called a chiastic structure. It's a reflective structure. It's things further in the mirror appear further. And as they get closer, they appear closer. And this is what's happening. But why is this so exciting to me? Big deal. So, you know, very nice that the first of the year is going to be Nisan. It's very exciting because the very exact same literary device, chiasm, was used to describe when man was created. Vayivra ha'adam betzalmo, betzelim, vayivra elokim et ha'adam betzalmo, betzelim elokim bara oto. The same exact CBA, ABC structure is used to describe us, is used to describe every human. Now, what's being said is even more exciting. So besides that, the rebirth, because the creation of man is now going to beautifully parallel the recreation of the nation, and they're going to become now, you know, sovereign people in a free country. This is the very beginnings of it. What's being said here is equally as exciting. It's not going to sound exciting at first because there's almost nothing exciting about matzah. But what's being said here is that you're going to eat matzah for 7 days and you can't eat chametz. And so, sorry. Sorry.
I mean, the build up to that kind of shot, that line was better than the line. I'm sorry.
Yes.
Great.
Okay, so now I have to deliver. Okay. We gave a very big build up. Yeah, I was choking on myself. Okay. I was going through the narrow straits to come out. So I got my breath back. So I read a magnificent, magnificent article by Harav Uriel Etam. He's a rabbi in Yeshivat Haritzion in the Gush, where I used to go in the summertime. And he wrote something that just totally made me rethink everything. And he says the simplest Masechet Berachot that says that in the Garden of Eden, the tree of knowledge, the tree of knowledge, good and evil, he said it was wheat. And back in the day, the fruit of that tree was actually bread. And to just, if it sounds too crazy, there's a beautiful pasuk that after Adam is discovered as having eaten from the forbidden fruit, which now is being suggested was bread, his punishment is, oh, you want to eat bread? I'll tell you how you're going to eat bread. Beze'at apecha tocha lechem. If you want, why would God use as part of the retribution? Why would he use as part of his, I'll call it a punishment, even though that's not what it is, but why would his reaction, why would God's reaction be to Adam, who ate from a forbidden fruit, why would his reaction be, oh, you want to eat bread, you're going to have to work for it? Unless the forbidden fruit itself was bread. Now, that to me was earth-shattering enough, but then it goes further. Well, if the Etz Hada'at Tov Hara was bread, then what was Etz HaChaim? The tree of life, which they were allowed to eat from. It was barricaded for them to eat from when? Once they sinned, God said, if you eat from Etz HaChaim, you might live forever. And you can't live forever because you ate from the bread tree. I'll call the tree of knowledge, good and bad, I'll call it the bread tree so you could follow a little bit more easily. Let's talk about this for a second, because to me it's very exciting. What is God saying here in Egypt? We didn't even leave yet, which is exciting in and of itself, that the redemption starts where? The redemption starts in the depths of the, what do you want to call this place? Hellhole, that was Egypt. That's where the redemption starts. And in order for this redemption to literally manifest itself, we have to make a commitment that for 7 days we're not going to eat bread. And instead of bread, we're going to eat matzot. So I had said that matzot would be the food that we normally ate when? In Gan Eden, matzot. It was flour and water. It's a little scary how closely related flour and water matzah is to what? Bread. To bread. Some people go as far as to say it was two trees, but from the same root. But that's already a story for another day. What is God telling the people now? When you're preparing to leave from Egypt, what should be on your mind? I'm asking you, I'm telling you, you need to eat from the tree of life. Think of it. Matzah is sustaining. It's flat, it's flour, it's water, it's all you need to sustain life. Now, they didn't really love, they weren't excited about sustaining life in the Garden of Eden. Why? Because life abounded. Everything was teeming with life. There was no expiration date. Nobody would, today, we're all fixated on preserving life and eating healthy and a long life and health, because why? Because it's not a given in this world. In Eden, life was a given. So eating from the tree of life wasn't so exciting to them. Why do they decide they want to eat from the bread tree, from the tree that is going to give them something more exciting? It says that Chava had a desire for it. Because we always desire something that's A, forbidden, beautiful, but what else? We didn't appreciate the matzah. We didn't appreciate the fact that life was something that was so wholesale. It was so easy to come by. So what God is telling us here, when he tells us in Egypt, once a year, I want you to stop eating. Okay, I should say this. Why do we eat bread today? We say, Hamotzi lechem min ha'aretz, we wash. I don't want to paint the bread as being the evil food. In our new reality, where we are today, where we are living a completely different existence, bread is allowed for us. Because we are people that have desires, that have appetites, and so that food does nourish and sustain us. But it doesn't mean that we should keep our eye off the ball, that we should forget about plan A. What was plan A? Plan A was to eat from the tree of life. Plan A was to eat the matzah. So as we're about to leave Egypt, what does God tell Moshe? Tell the people, that very tree, the tree of life that was blocked off, that they were not allowed to access again, I'm making it accessible to them. I'm going to ask them to eat that matzah again because I want to nourish them once again with the food that they ate when they were primitive, pristine, untainted in any kind of way. Passover is the time that we go back to eating matzah, that we eat the food that we ate in Gan Eden, that we eat from the tree of life, because this idea, the idea that we are remembering, as you said, where we came from, we're remembering our ideals, we're remembering our original potentials, we eat from that on Passover, because that's going to nourish us. That's what's going to give us the ability to be able to move forward and to go back to a place where, wah, where we had a lot of ruach, where God literally breathed into us this purity, the sense of ability, the sense that anything we choose to do, we can do. Yes, Everything has its opposite. And I say that because I'm going to have to, I see the time is ticking, but I will just say this. The parasha ends with two very interesting pieces. One of them is the mitzvah of tefillin. Now, really, I love everybody, but of all of the mitzvot, as we're leaving Egypt, to throw, as it looks like a little copy-paste, we don't know where to stick mitzvah tefillin, so we'll stick it into the end of parashat bo. I don't think that's what's being said. God is telling us, and it's the men who need to do this, because they say the women, it comes naturally and intrinsically to us. The men have to wear tefillin as an ot al yadecha and totafot ben enecha. What does that mean? It means that your actions and your thoughts and your actions have to balance, have to weigh in, have to balance each other out. The same way that your heart and the mind has to balance each other out, the same way that the lungs need to give air for sound to come out, the same way that we have to have part chametz and part matzah. 1 week you eat matzah, the rest of the week you eat, the rest of the year we eat chametz. And the last thing that we have in this parasha, which is so beautiful, which also you'd think has nothing to do with nothing, is the law of Pidyon HaBen. And why, how on earth do the laws, it's in this parasha, the Pidyon HaBen, the law of Pidyon HaBen is right here in chapter 13, verse 13, so it's easy to remember, even verse 12, all peterechem, of animals or people, a pidyon haben means that you need to redeem the firstborn child, the firstborn animal, the firstborn donkey. All the firstborns need to be redeemed.
Is that a precursor to the firstborns being dying? Is that a?
It comes. It's actually after the firstborns were spared.
Ah, okay.
So what is God saying? He's saying I'm glad you used the word precursor, because before this whole story started, God said three words, B'ni Bechori Yisrael. My eldest child is Yisrael. My eldest child, we are considered God's eldest. We are the inheritors. We are the ones that are supposed to set the example for the rest of the world. And at the end, just as about we're leaving Egypt, God gives this law to us. And it might be a reaction to the fact that all the firstborn Egyptians were killed and the firstborn Jewish people were spared. And so therefore, since I spared all of the firstborns, they belong to me. And if you want them, you need to redeem them. They need to be redeemed. And I think it sends a beautiful message, not just for the firstborns, but that we're all God's firstborns. B'ni Bechori Yisrael. God expects of us to be the ones who are going to set the example. He expects of us to be the ones who are going to make sure that the rest of the world follows our lead. He didn't just take us out of Egypt so that we could eat grapes from our vineyards in Israel. He took us out because B'ni Bechori Yisrael. So yes, we are the firstborns, but we have a responsibility. And I think this parasha is really just on the simplest terms telling us that there's not one straight path and there's not one straight emotion. We have to use everything, the heart, the lungs, the mind, the voice, our hands. All of this has to come together. Our thoughts and our actions all have to be working, kol atzmotai, all of our bones, all of our limbs. When we come to stand in front of God, not only all of our physical parts, but all of our emotions, our fears, our hopes, our dreams, our enthusiasm, our practicality, everything that we are comes to weigh in on this relationship that we have with Hashem. When we do that, when we access all the parts of ourselves, then what does God do? He brings all the parts of His self. And why it's so beautiful, and I'll end with this, it's not just God's Yad Chazakah. He doesn't just talk about having a strong hand and being a person of action. He has these words, and to me, this is the icing on the cake. Zeroa netuya. You know what a zeroa netuya is? It's an outstretched arm. So as we're going through this process and we're wondering, how are we going to get to this utopian place? How are we going to get to a place where we can eat again from the tree of life? How are we going to be able to stand up? How are we going to get past all of these trials and all of these beatings that we've been taken? God says, my hand is a zeroa netuya. My hand is a hand that's always outstretched. So I don't care what deficiencies you may have in your calculations of whether or not you're able to accomplish what you think you can or can't accomplish. Think of me, says God, as the one who has his arm stretched out. All you have to do is what? Put your arm out, take one step forward. My hand is out there waiting to pull you, to carry you, to assist you, to guide you, and to take you to the promised lands that, God willing, we all as a nation, personally and as a nation, will be able to reach.
Amen.
Thank you.